All right. So, assumptions of radiometric dating. I cannot draw, but I can draw if my marker would work. This one's got any juice. All right. That, believe it or not, is a rock. All right? We're going to say that is
a... All right, then. See that? That's a rock.
Okay, that's a rock. So we're going to say this is a sample of uranium-238. So different elements, we're just going to breeze through this really quick. Different elements have different isotopes, and so there are different numbers of elements that can have different numbers of protons, and so uranium would have 238 protons, is all that means. But you can have uranium with 237, I think you can have it with 239. So when you have these isotopes, essentially what you have is each sample would have a number of... So each sample would have a number of parent isotopes and daughter isotopes. And so just for the sake of argument, we'll say that the X's are the parents and then the zeros are the daughters. And what they can do is they can look at this sample of uranium and say, based on the number of parents and the number of daughters, we can estimate how old this sample is. Because what happens with isotopes is, initially, this rock had nothing but parents, so it would be straight X's. But as time goes along, those X's devolve into daughter isotopes, which then become zeros. And so you can look at the rock, and then if you look into the rock on a smaller scale, you can tell how many parent isotopes and how many daughter isotopes are in that sample. So hypothetically, you could be able to determine a rough estimate of how old this rock is. I watched a video today that said that, of course, Mount Rushmore is fairly new, but the stone it was carved into was 1.7 billion years old. So whenever you hear those massive numbers, those estimates of how old something is, this is the method that they're using, is radiometric dating. So the assumptions of radiometric dating, that's the handout, one of the handouts I gave you. Dr. Andrew Snelling is a young earth creationist, and he is a geologist. He's not a member of the church, but his research is great. It's very, very helpful. And so, basically, if you're going to use this method, you have to assume three different things. And those are listed here. And again, this is the work of Dr. Snelling. This is not mine at all. Assumption number one is you have to assume that the amounts of parent and daughter atoms at the beginning must be known. In other words, you have to know the initial conditions. And essentially, you cannot know the initial conditions. You can't know how many parent isotopes or how many daughter isotopes were there in that sample at the beginning. So therefore, you can't estimate how old that sample is. And there in the highlight is kind of where he points out the problem. It says the daughter atoms are known to have been inherited when rocks form. And so in other words, if you've got another sample over here of uranium-238, there can be contamination. These daughter and parent isotopes kind of spread like germs, and so they can go between samples. And so just because I have so many daughter isotopes in this sample, they could have come from this one. So therefore, it's not very accurate because you don't know how many were there initially. So that's the first problem. Problem number two is that all daughter atoms measured today must only have been derived by in situ radioactive decay of parent atoms. And he says that subsequent contamination is common. Again, you can't know those initial conditions. And even if it isn't detected, it doesn't mean that contamination isn't present. And then number three, the radioactive decay rate must have been constant at today's measured rate. And so uranium-238 is going to devolve into, I believe, lead. I'm terrible at chemistry. I hated chemistry. But I believe it devolves into lead. And so each sample would devolve into something else. And so uranium-238 is the slowest one. It takes the longest for the parent isotopes to become daughter isotopes. And then there are some that have half-lives, some elements that have half-lives of like seconds. So in other words, the element is formed and then it's already decayed within a matter of moments. This one, the estimates that they give is billions of years before half of your parent isotopes turn into daughter isotopes. But what they're unable to to be absolutely sure of is that those rates have been constant. We don't know that those rates are constant. Those are the rates right now, but they could have been slower in the past. They could have been faster in the past. And so this method of dating is it sounds good, but there's so many assumptions there, you cannot be sure about the dates that they pass off. And so saying that the stone that Mount Rushmore was carved into is 1.7 billion years old, there's no way that they can know that. They're making so many assumptions that it's
unscientific.
It's a very unscientific is a very good way of putting it. Yeah. So that was free. So that was just that was something I thought was interesting that you might find encouraging. Whenever it gets into dating things and discussing the age of the universe, this is where they're getting their numbers from, is this method of radiometric dating. So once you understand the assumptions that go into that, it's not quite as intimidating, at least for me, because it's like, okay, well, that makes sense, but at the same time, you're making several assumptions that you can't account for. So now we'll actually get into the packet itself, the evidence for a young universe. Let's go ahead and drop down to number three. This is something that isn't going to be a shocker, I don't think, for any of us, but if you look at the timeline from creation all the way up to the present age, from creation to Abraham, roughly 1900 years. Let's pause there for a moment. That's amazing to me. That's less than 10 chapters of scripture covers 1900 years. And then you have some blocks of scripture like Abraham to Moses where you have entire books that are written. So it's just interesting to me that first 1900 years we have very, very little information compared to as far as time goes. So from Abraham to Moses, 450 roughly. Moses to Christ, roughly 1500. And then from Christ to the present is roughly 2000, giving us a grand total of about 6,000 years old from creation all the way up to the present. And so with that in mind, why is the age of the universe important? Is this just unimportant quibble? Is this, just a detail that doesn't really matter in the long run? Why is this important for us as Christians?
Because you make God a liar.
Okay.
Or you make him out to be a liar. You can't really make him liar with you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
The very fact that he gives genealogy, and genealogy goes back to the creation.
Yes.
Just like you have... who's the seventh from Adam? Who's that? I can't remember.
Enoch,
Jude, Book of Jude. So Enoch being the seventh from Adam. And so by the time in which the earth was created to that, we know that we can say this amount of time has elapsed.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's very, very important because we can say, based on this, this is the timeline God has given us. And if God is right, if God is true, and he is, then that has to be correct because God is omniscient. He knows all things. But one thing we do need to be careful about is we can't use the Bible's genealogies to prove the age of the earth. We can't use it to prove anything because that's the logical fallacy of begging the question. If I assume that the Bible is accurate, therefore based on my belief that the Bible is accurate, let me put it this way. If someone doesn't believe in God, using the genealogies in the Bible to try to prove to them that the earth is only 6,000 years old isn't going to do any good. And they're probably going to say that you're begging the question is the logical fallacy that's being committed there. So absolutely, it's very important that we know those things because if God is right, and he is, then that timeline should be accurate. But we need to be very, very careful about using scripture to prove those things when someone doesn't even believe those assumptions to begin with. So we kind of have to get on the same page before we can start using scripture to prove scripture for a person that's outside of that. So I have a quote there that I really like by George Wall. Of course, he wasn't a Christian, and he's a secular scientist. He says, "Time is the hero of the plot. Given so much time, the impossible becomes possible, the possible becomes probable, and the probable becomes virtually certain. One has only to wait. Time itself performs miracles." The secular scientist has to have long periods of time. Back when Darwin was first putting his theory together, estimates for the age of the universe, I believe, was like, is either 1 million or 1 billion. Like, he didn't think that he needed much time at all, but the more and more science we know, the more and more we understand about how things work, especially with biology, and even with some astrophysics, we know that there's no possible way for us to be at where we are now with that short period of time. And so they keep throwing time at it as time goes along. So an ancient Earth doesn't fit into the biblical timeline, and nor can it effectively answer the evidence provided below. So we'll look at four different lines of evidence. And these are so encouraging to me. I thought this was awesome. So evidence number one for a young universe. And these are, you know, these are evidences that we can take out and use with our friends, you know, if they have questions. Just give them some things to consider. Many times I think we might think, well, that my arguments aren't sophisticated enough, or I don't know enough, or I'm not confident enough to talk to someone who's an atheist. But they're people just like we are. And many times it's not the sophisticated arguments that win people over. There's a video I really enjoy. To Christopher Hitchens, which of course is, you know, he's notorious for opposing Christianity and the existence of God. And in that video, he says that the strongest argument that we have for evolution not being true is the teleological argument, is the argument from design, is essentially saying there's so much design here, it couldn't have come from nothing. And he's saying that's the strongest argument that they have, is the fact that there's so much design, and where did it come from? How was it written? How does DNA, how does it have more material than the entire Encyclopedia Britannica several hundred times over? They can't explain that. And so many times it's not the sophisticated arguments that can win people over. Sometimes it's just something like this. So I hope these are encouraging. Number one, the level of topography on the continents. So in other words, we have mountains, we have valleys, there are different elevations. Outside of San Angelo, there are different elevations. So you go to Colorado, there's these massive mountains, there's cliffs, there's the Grand Canyon, further to the west. The problem is, if you look at the current rates of erosion taking place today, and that much amount of time estimated by the evolutionists, if you look at the rate of erosion and the amount of the volume of soil that we still have today, I believe the continent should be wiped clean every 14 million years. Because our rate of erosion is 27.5 billion tons per year. We know the current volume of land mass above sea level. And so if we just take the rate of erosion, we look at the current rate, the current volume of land mass, then we should be able to know every 14 million years we start over and we have nothing but just flat. Everything is sea level every 14 million years because of the rate of erosion. But that's not what we see. We still have mountains. We still have the canyons and those things. And they have a hard time getting around that conclusion. And one of the things that they'll say is, well, you know, the mountains are still growing. The tectonic plates are still moving. And so that's what's adding that extra volume. But that simply doesn't work because the older rocks are still on the surface. Does that make sense? So like the rocks that are still really, really old, they haven't eroded. They're still on top. They're still on the surface. And so if they haven't eroded, then it doesn't make sense for that to be the source of new rock, of new material. So just the simple fact that we have mountains today is evidence that the world could not be as old as they say that it is, which is interesting. You don't have to look very far to find evidence for a young universe. So this is where it gets interesting, is number two. The levels of oceanic salinity. If you've ever gone down to the Mississippi River, specifically the Mississippi Delta, and just seen how muddy that water is, just the amount of dirt and soil and sand that's just coursing through that river that's being flushed out into the Gulf. I actually don't have it on this sheet, but they've done studies, and they've essentially said that if the topography of the United States is the same that it has been for millions and billions of years, the Gulf of Mexico should be completely full of sediment simply from the Mississippi River. The Mississippi River pushes out so much soil and sediment, it should be completely full. There should be no Gulf of Mexico if the continent of North America is as old as they say that it is. So what are the sources of input? We have sodium, we have all this salinity in our oceans. Where does it come from? It comes from rivers, comes from the ocean floor. Glaciers, whenever they melt, then they release sediment into the water. It comes from volcanoes, it comes from groundwater. And so we have input into the river, into the oceans. We also have output. So believe it or not, whenever the ocean, slaps up against the rocks and spray is released into the air, salinity is lost from the ocean in that way. And those aerosols go into the atmosphere. So we lose it through that. We lose it through halite deposition, alteration of the seafloor basalt. So in other words, all that to say this, we have salinity coming into the ocean and we have it coming out of the ocean. And so if we know the rates, if we know the current amount of salt in our ocean, which is fairly simple to calculate, and we know the current rate that we're losing salt and the current rate that we're putting it in, we should be able to calculate the maximum age of the oceans. Because, again, like we said, if the oceans are, they calculate the oceans to be 3.8 billion years old. If the oceans are 3.8 billion years old, then we should have a massive amount of salinity in those oceans because of the erosion that's taking place and all that stuff that's being lost into the ocean. So if you take those things, and I actually got this material from this book right here, which again, y'all are welcome to look at it after class. This specific study that Dr. Morris did, he used the minimum input rates and the maximum output rates. All that to say this is he's essentially giving the evolutionists as much leeway as he possibly can. He's trying to make the numbers work in their favor. So the absolute roof for the age of our oceans, based on what he found, is... I know that's small, sorry. 32 million years. That's the maximum age of our oceans. But they quoted it at 3.8 billion. 3.8 billion with a B. Maximum age is 32 million years old. That's number two. Look at number three. Look at the levels of atmospheric helium. If you've had to buy balloons recently, you've probably heard something about the helium shortage. It's very difficult to find helium in the party stores now because there's less and less in the atmosphere. We know that it's the second lightest gas next to hydrogen. There's a few notes there about how helium is produced. And it's the same concept here under number three. If we know the current rate that we're gaining helium, and we know the current rate that we're losing helium, and then we simply look at the current amount of helium in our atmosphere, then we should be able to determine how old our atmosphere is. Because we know how much helium is being added, we know how much helium is being lost, and we know how much we currently have. Therefore, based on those numbers, we should be able to say this is how old our atmosphere is. The current rate of addition is 13 million helium atoms per square inch per second. He even calculated the rate that helium is escaping into the atmosphere or into space, and it's 0.3 million helium atoms per square inch per second. So assuming that constant rate of addition, the maximum age of our atmosphere is 2 million years. So you see how we're working the number down? The oceans can only be 32 million years old. The atmosphere can only be 2 million years old. So we're starting to get closer and closer to the biblical timeline. And then number four, the decay of Earth's magnetic field. And this one is also, I think this one is so cool. Of course, we know that the Earth has a North Pole and a South Pole. And that, of course, is referring to Earth's magnetic field. If you've ever used a compass, you have a basic idea of how this works. And the strength of this field is very fluid. It moves up and down, and it's currently decaying. In fact, it's decaying so quickly that in 8,000 years, the Earth will no longer have a magnetic field, which is important because the magnetic field is what protects us from a lot of meteor collisions and all that other space debris. And also, a lot of ultraviolet radiation is kind of moved away from the Earth based simply because of our magnetic field. Same thought here. If we know the current strength of the magnetic field, we know the rate that it's decaying, and we know the rate that it's decaying very specifically because they've been measuring this since like the early 1800s. So we know the rate that it's decaying. We know specifically how strong it currently is. Then we can determine the maximum age of life on Earth. Because again, life cannot exist on Earth without this magnetic field. It simply cannot be done. And the maximum age of that, based on our current rates, is 20,000 years. They can only go back 20,000 years and say, this is how old life on Earth is. It has to be 20,000 years, because you can't have life on Earth without a magnetic field. And we know the rate that it's decaying. And so less than 100,000 years ago, our magnetic field would have been so strong that it would have essentially been as strong as a neutron star. So you take the decay rate and you extrapolate backwards. You work backwards. Then you can essentially determine and say, this amount of time backwards, it would have been too strong for life to exist. So it can't be too strong. It can't be too weak. It's got to be somewhere in the middle. And so in a certain amount of time, it'll be gone. And then if we work backwards, then we know that life couldn't have existed then because it would have been too strong. Another thing I'll mention, I didn't put this specifically here, but we also know that the Earth and the Moon are moving apart. I believe it's a certain number of centimeters per year. And so it's moving away at a certain rate per year. I don't know the specific numbers, but I do know that if you only go back like 1 or 2 billion years ago, the rate that they're moving apart, the Earth and the Moon should be touching at that point in time. So, again, you look at the numbers, and it works from a biological standpoint because they need it to get their theory off the ground. But if you simply look at some of these processes in nature, it simply doesn't work. It simply doesn't work. You have the levels of oceanic salinity. You have the level of topography on the continents, atmospheric helium, and the Earth's magnetic field. You take all those things together, and we've worked it down from 32 million years all the way to 20,000, which is a lot closer than the estimates that they're giving us. So super interesting stuff. And we actually went through that a lot quicker than I thought we would. I get excited about this stuff, so I talk too fast. Are there any comments, questions, thoughts?
So how do you get them to the Bible once you get them down to 20,000?
That's a good question. That's a good question. So I think if you were to show them these things and you were to work them down to that number and just say, you know, look at a few of these processes, and essentially the name of the game that they're playing is uniformitarianism. So they argue that everything that's taking place today has been taking place since the Earth, you know, was first formed. And so if you play that game, then they have to admit these problems. And these are problems that they don't know how to answer. Yes. Did you have something?
I did, but you were in the middle of a thought, and I didn't want to interrupt.
Oh, you're fine.
No.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, if you just show them, you know, this is the game that you're playing, these are the problems with that, then I think they would have to be more open. I think they would have to be. And then just essentially, I would just treat it like any other Bible study, just trying to set it up with someone and just say, hey, you know, let's talk about this more.
I guess so, I'll go for the gentleman after the get them down to 20,000.
Got their throat?
Well, just because this says 20,000 years is the maximum age of life doesn't
right.
mean there was life at that time.
Yeah, exactly. And each one of these studies, they gave them as the longest amount. So they gave them the benefit of the doubt. They made the numbers work in favor of the secular scientists. And so these numbers are actually very, very generous to them. So yeah. Yes, ma'am?
I was just going to add, to the question, how do you go from these numbers to Scripture? And if you go what we would call outside, you know, biblical evidence, like if you go beyond Scripture, because God is the one who created everything, and He's the one who not only just wrote down what happened, but also provides evidence of Himself. I just thought of Romans 1, because the evidence that God is here has been, like, clearly made manifest in the world that we live in. So if you are able to prove that this is contradictory to what we're commonly being told, and it's much more closer in correlation to what Scripture teaches and what God says, that there's evidence for my existence, and I've been telling you that I've been here by just where you live, but also through Scripture, if you're able to connect those two.
Yeah.
In that way, maybe something in their mind will click to be more open to hearing what Warren has to say about
it. Yeah, and 9 times out of 10, the atheist is going to argue for evidence. You know, they're going to argue from a scientific perspective. And so if you show them the assumptions of radiometric dating, like, this is where you're getting your numbers from. You know, all these estimates that the Earth is a certain age, this is where you're getting it from, and these are the flaws in that reasoning. These are the assumptions that you're making that have been shown to have problems time and time again. And then you show them these numbers and just say, hey, listen, you know, by your own reasoning, from a uniformitarianism perspective, it doesn't work, because we shouldn't have life that old, because the magnetic field would be too strong, the oceans would be completely full of sediment, we would have no continents, they would just be, you know, flat sea level, and then we would have essentially no helium in the atmosphere. And so if you just show them those things, if they're honest, which, you know, that comes into every Bible study that you try to set up, if they're honest, that should at least cause them to question. I think that'll get the ball rolling in your favor.
Well, I'm just going to bring something up. When, I don't remember, was it 3 years, 4 years ago when we went to Grand Canyon? 4 years ago. We went to Grand Canyon, and they have this plaque here that says, find the great unconformity. And there's literally 1.2 billion years of missing rock record if you go by what the scientists say the age of the Earth is.
Yeah.
And as you know, south rim, as you're going up that south rim, there's a path that you can take that starts out here that says, claims, well, this was, you know, 300,000 years old, I forget where it actually starts. But it goes all the way up to 1.7 or 1.6 billion years that the world has been here.
Yeah.
But then they admit that they can't account for 1.2 million years of rock that should be there. Mm-hmm. And that amazed me. I just had to take a picture of that and say, this, you know, that they're actually acknowledging that they're wrong here.
Yeah. And another problem that they have is, especially with the Grand Canyon, you've seen pictures and you know how flat the layers are. They can account for that because the topography of our land today, it isn't that flat.
No.
You know, it's, you know, we've got valleys, we've got mountains, and so, you know, in the Grand Canyon, you should see rises and falls. You know, you should see what erosion actually looks like. But the fact that they're so flat implies that they were laid down very, very quickly.
Yes.
Which, of course, would go back to the Noahic flood. So, yeah. Good stuff.
Well, when I said I would go for the juggler, if I get him down to 20,000 feet, I want to ask one question.
Mm-hmm.
Where does consciousness arise?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I asked that to an atheist in Abilene at a, what was that? It was a Q&A. Man, he was stumbling all over the place. He was asking a question.
Yeah.
Well, we're still researching that. We don't know. Of course you don't know. And so once you get them down there, you've already caused doubt. Whether or not they believe it or not is on them.
Yeah.
But you've already established doubt in their argumentation. Now I'm just going to just cut the throat. You know.
Yeah. Good stuff. This is awesome stuff. I love this stuff because it shows us that we're not forcing the Bible to say things that it doesn't say. And the things that we believe are in harmony with the evidence that's been properly interpreted. And that's the important piece there is if you interpret the evidence properly, then you do get these numbers. And it simply doesn't work from their perspective. So it's comforting to me. I think it's encouraging that, you know, there is evidence, there is reason behind why we believe what we believe. And, you know, God didn't create us to blindly accept things and to not ask questions. He created us to reason. He created us to think through things, to be critical and to evaluate. And the fact that the earth reflects that so clearly is just evidence of that.
He expects us to be rational.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, he is the most rational, if you can say, use the term being, that exists. And we're made in his spiritual image. Why would he expect us to be just irrational?
Yeah.
And you look at everything, like the day eggs theory, the gap theory. Every one of them have holes, just look like Swiss cheese. I mean, they're terrible.
Yeah.
And yet people buy into them. They're irrational about it. They're rational about most anything else in life.
Mm-hmm.
But they become irrational when they go to the Bible and they look at what the scientists are saying.
Yeah.
You know, they just become totally irrational. Well, the scientists wouldn't lie to us. Maybe rethink that one.
Yeah.
It's easier to make broad assumptions about things that you don't fully understand and just say, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
When if they were asked about some things that they have experienced or have come to understand, like the battles of life or difficulties and struggles that they have, like personally, then they develop these strong opinions.
Yeah.
But it's easy just to be like fed information, be like, oh, yeah, I guess that.
Yes,
ma'am. I think lots of times they're just rebellious and they don't want to be in subjection to God. I read this real cute little thing last few days. It was about this young man who went off to college and came back to visit his Bible class teacher. And she said, well, come on in, I'll fix you some breakfast. And he said, well, so I just want to let you know that I don't believe in God anymore. And she said, oh, I hate to hear that. She said, where did this egg come from? And he said, from a chicken. And she said, well, where did the chicken come from? He said, from the egg. And she said, well, which is it? Did the chicken come from the egg or the egg from the chicken? He said, you've got me all mixed up. I don't know. He said, well, if you can't explain where a chicken came from, how do you expect me to believe you can explain the origin of the universe?
Sure.
So something so simple can be crippling to them.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, just at the very foundation, the moment before the Big Bang occurred, they have to argue that nothing existed. And if you'll peg them on this, they'll have to be straightforward with you. There are only two options. Either matter is eternal or matter came from nothing. They don't want to argue that matter is eternal, so they have to argue that matter came from nothing. They have to argue that there was nothing, and then the singularity, that little point that exploded, giving us the Big Bang, they have to argue that they don't know where that came from. So, if you'll push them on that, that's something that they can't explain.
And if you ask them what is the origin of the Big Bang Theory, they might be a little surprised because it arose out of a lie. And, well, I'll bring it up later.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Very cool. I find numbers interesting. I've been sitting on your data here. 7% of the magnetic field has been lost since 1829. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And so I'm not sure what the actual date they measured that, 2019, 2018. If that's 2019, that's 190 years. So 7% equals 190 years. If you're constant and consistent, you take 190 years and you... 7% out of 100, you're going to get about 14.3. Okay? 7%. If 7% has been lost, they're having to assume a rate of magnetism in that.
Right.
If you take 7% out of 100, you're going to get about 14.3.
Mm-hmm. So
multiply 190 years times 14.3, that's only 2,000 something years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 2,000 something years, the magnetic field should be gone. We're in trouble.
From their perspective.
I'm just saying, you know, that's where numbers and the science and so forth is very intriguing. I mean, math works, but I mean, you can't measure God.
Yeah. Very true. All right. Thanks, guys. Good comments. That's their numbers, the rates that were measured per year. So. You want to have anything else?
No.